the brethren and sisters and the young people. Well, although we're almost halfway through the calendar year, we've only had four studies in the book of Romans, being a month since our last one, and God willing, it will be a month before our next one. We really have come to appreciate that the basic theme of the book so far is really very simple. Paul's reasoning, on the other hand, can sound very profound. But I think the thing that we want to establish is that Romans is an outstanding book. It's got a wonderful exposition on the principles of the righteousness of God, and by implication, therefore, an outstanding exhortation as well. And so, as we said in our opening study some months ago, it is our desire in going through this book to keep it as basic as possible. In reading through chapter 2 tonight, some of you may have thought, oh, this is getting very complex. Well, it's only complex in the sense that in many of the chapters, Paul is reasoning with the Jews in the way in which a Jew would reason. And where the complexity comes in is not so much in the answer that Paul gives to the questions that he poses, but sometimes in even understanding what the question is all about. Because these people had problems which in many ways were unique to the Jewish people. And so we will endeavour as we go through to understand what their problem was, and usually when we've understood what the problem was, the answer then is quite easy and apparent. I'd like to therefore just briefly review what we've done up to this stage. And this in no way is duplicating the work of what has been done in the excellent resumes that we've had. The epistle, as we saw in our opening study, was written from Corinth towards the end of the apostle's stay in that particular city, recorded in Acts chapter 20 and verse 3. At that particular stage, Paul was contemplating a visit to Jerusalem, even though it was fraught with imminent peril to himself. This comes out in the words of Romans 15 and verse 31. He had hoped that if he escaped with his life, that he would one day visit Rome, which of course we know did eventually happen. The letter, therefore, to the Romans was meant in part to prepare the ecclesia there to receive him when he came. It was meant also as a permanent record of the doctrinal results which Paul felt that he had attained as the fruit of the fierce conflict with the Judaizing Christians through which he had just passed. So for this purpose, the ecclesia that was slowly gathering as the result of isolated and casual efforts in the capital of the world was both by its position and its constitution an eminently suitable correspondent. And so that's all we really know about the background to the book. Not really a lot of importance, therefore, in the background. In the opening salutation found in the first seven verses, Paul outlines there his commission, which was to preach the gospel to the Gentiles, the gospel of the fulfillment of God's promises in his Son to all the Gentiles and consequently to the Romans as well. He thanks God for their faith, and he expresses his longing desire to visit them in verses 8 to 13, and also to preach to them the power of the gospel of the righteousness of God, which he mentions in verses 14 to 17. This gospel, he points out, met the crying need of the whole world, for God's wrath against sin was only too evident, as we see in verses 18 to 32 of that chapter. He had revealed himself, that is, God had revealed himself in creation, but men had refused to acknowledge him, as he outlines in verses 18 to 23 of that part of the chapter. So God had left them to the prey of unnatural lusts, which he outlines in quite some detail in verses 24 through to 27, and then ultimately to their own perverted judgment of what was right and what was wrong. That's really how we have come so far. Let's summarise then what we expect to see in chapter 2. Some indeed, amongst the people to whom he was writing, or at least whom he had visited, blinded their eyes to their own relation to this wrath by assuming a position as judges of others. And we would have noticed that in chapter 2 that we read this evening in the first 16 verses. A certain group whom he just styles representatively, O man. But we're going to see particularly that he's now going to be speaking to the Jewish people. He's dealt with the Gentile problem, now he's going to speak to the Jews. Now these people were setting themselves up as judges, as he says. Or, when we come to verse 17, they claim to be teachers of others. But God requires obedience, not censoriousness. It's not a matter of saying, I have received the law, therefore that automatically makes me better than someone else. Or even more so, because I'm so good and my nation is so good, God has given me the law, therefore I must automatically be good. God requires obedience to that particular law. And he tries each man with absolute fairness on the basis of the life that that person has received. And we'll see that particularly in verses 12 to 16 of this chapter tonight. He sets no store on the possession of the law and circumcision unless the heart is in correspondence with them. And then he goes on in chapter 3 to show that the Jew indeed was very privileged above other men in being entrusted with the oracles of God. So I do anticipate that all being well, we will cover all of chapter 2 this evening. We don't intend to go in depth into every word. We want to pick up, though, the general line of the argument as it goes through this chapter. We trust that you all received a copy of the notes that I'm working to on your way in this evening. An introductory comment, I think, is necessary, inasmuch as you'll find there's a page 14 on the front, and some of you may have noted that you got a page 14 last time. That's correct. I'd appreciate if you destroyed the page 14 you got last time and replace it with the page 14 you've got this time. The immediate question going through your mind is, why should that be the case? Well, it's because of the comment I had on verse 32. The comment in itself is not wrong, but in considering chapter 2 in detail in preparation for tonight's class, I felt it was inappropriate in my comment on verse 32, as handed out last time, to quote chapter 2 verses 14 and 15 in proof of the statement. The statement itself was essentially correct. The quote chapter 2 verses 14 and 15 I do not think is a proof of that statement, and therefore the note has been altered, and substantially what it has done is it's left out chapter 2 verse 14 and 15 as the quote, and you may notice I've also left out the words moral sense and conscience, just in case they may have been misunderstood. So what we're saying then is that verse 32 stands in its own right on the basis of what has been said in that chapter. When we get to verses 14 and 15 of chapter 2 this evening, you'll perhaps see why I prefer that comment to be altered. No doubt most of you are aware that the Epistle to the Romans has been regarded over the years as a difficult one to understand. And there has from time to time been controversy over the interpretation of parts of Romans. For that reason, therefore, I'm trying to be very careful in the words I use, and particularly those put into print. Therefore, I have no hesitation in correcting something if I think it is necessary. Thanks to the brother who pointed that out to me at the end of the last class, and I agree with his comment that that was an incorrect use of chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. We come then to Romans chapter 2 this evening. The notes which you've got there, which go from page 15 to 19, as I've mentioned, are essentially the notes that I'm working to. If from time to time you think that I'm reading from the notes, you'll be quite correct. If you'd like to read along, then by all means do so. And so I would point out that in opening this, I think the comment from Brother Carter, which we have at the top of page 15, is worth considering verbatim. And I will therefore read that comment as an introduction to what we're going to be looking at here in Romans chapter 2 this evening. Commenting on the first 16 verses, which is the first of the two sections of chapter 2, John Carter says that before proving that the Jews were also guilty before God, Paul lays down the grounds of individual responsibility to God. The application of the principles stated leads to the conviction of the Jews as having failed to attain to righteousness. We'll just interrupt there for a moment. Paul is going to show quite clearly that no man can claim to have attained to the righteousness of God. It was quite clear that the Gentiles hadn't, but he was also going to point out to the Jews, you Jews are really no better than the Gentiles. In fact, you are really worse, because you know more than they do, but you're still doing the same things. And as we go on during the course of the night, we're going to say, that's all right for the Gentiles, that's all right for the Jews, now what about the Christadelphians? Because wherever you've got human beings, you've got the potential for the same principle to apply. Where much light has been given, much responsibility applies. Where much privilege has been given, much responsibility applies. Let's read on with Brother Carter's comment. While there is thus a distinct development in the argument, While the Gentiles had been suffered to go their own ways, and in blindness of heart had generally sunk to the state of depravity already described in chapter 1, someone might say, as indeed one in the position of the Jew would say, I assent to the case which is presented, but my position's a different one. Mine is one of privilege. I'm not blind, I can see. And the apostle replies, granted. And as you are in such a position, so you have a greater responsibility. As you individually see, so you become personally amenable to God's judgment to be declared by Christ. Greater privilege brings greater responsibility. And therefore, if we come immediately down to the year 1987, who in this world is the most privileged group of people? And there is no doubt as to the answer to that. Who then has the greatest responsibility to live up to a way of life which is in keeping with those particular things they know? And therefore, as we had condemned the Gentile in our last class in chapter 1, and as tonight we look at the Jew with his unjustified, unwarranted self-satisfaction, we ask ourselves the question, do we sometimes fit into the category of such a person? And that's the thing we're going to keep asking ourselves, whether I state it or whether I don't. Let's keep asking ourselves that question as we go through. And of course, over the top of all of this, we're going to see the wonderful principles of the righteousness of God coming out in what is styled in the King James Version, his goodness, or in other translations, his kindness. So overriding all of this, there is going to be the kindness of God. As we saw in our last class, we should be thankful to God for his kindness, and a heart full of thankfulness will not be like a Gentile and will not be like a Jew, but will be a true brother of Christ. And so in the opening verse there for chapter 2, we read in verse 1, therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same things. It's interesting the use of this word here, inexcusable, because it only occurs two times in the epistle. We've already seen it once, back in chapter 1 and verse 20. And there, of course, he was going to speak to the Gentiles. Remember what chapter 1 and verse 20 says? He says, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So that even though the Gentile world at large may not understand the truth, their very observation of creation, their very appreciation of the fact that there was a God, left them without excuse, and there was no excuse at all for them to drop to the depths of depravity as described in Romans chapter 1. No excuse, because they could see from the very observations of nature that there has to be an eternal power. So there's no excuse for the Gentiles. Paul starts off chapter 2 and says there's no excuse to anybody. And of course this O man here really means you Jews. But Paul, in his typical way of approaching people, doesn't jump straight into it. Later on in the chapter, he announces, I'm really talking to Jews. But you see, he gives the Jew the opportunity to say, well, you know, this could be me. And by the time we get to about verse 17, Paul says, yes, I am talking about you Jews. So, there are two inexcusable situations. The Gentile, who may not know the truth, but certainly by his observation of nature, should see that his very way of life was even against nature itself. But more so, the Jew, who was standing in judgment on that Gentile, but who was actually doing the same things. And we'll see later on in the chapter how he was doing the same things. He condemned idolatry, but he was quite happy to take the proceeds of idolatry. He might go and rob a temple, however that robbing might take place. The Jew, of course, would abhor the things of the Gentiles, but the Jew was quite happy to make money out of the Gentiles. The Christadelphians will not accept the principles of the world in words, but to what extent do we find ourselves becoming victims or involved in a way of life which involves principles which by our mouths we condemn, but by our actions we actually condone? And these are the things, of course, that cause us to see this as a very wonderfully exhortational chapter. So you see, therefore, he's going to talk about the fact that there is to be no excuse, whoever you are. So if the Gentiles in chapter 1 and verse 20 were to be without excuse, how much more then the Jews who had received God's law. They'd received it, they knew it was wrong. The Gentiles didn't know it was wrong from God's law, but they knew it just by its nature. You know, the people out in the world who are indulging in all sorts of immorality, they know it's wrong. They try to pass it off and say it's not, and they try to make legislation which gets everybody thinking that it's not, but deep down they know it's wrong, even though they don't know the truth. We know it's wrong. And of course, we must teach our children that it's wrong. And therefore, we would expect to see in our lives something which is commensurate with what we believe. Of course, we will fail from time to time. And Paul's going to make allowances for that. And so we're not trying to say here that we're going to achieve perfect obedience. Of course we're not. And Paul is going to show to us how the righteousness of God can be beautifully revealed when we come, all being well, to chapter 4, in the case of a man like David who committed a dreadful sin, but God's kindness was there because his righteousness was upheld. So the reasoning at the moment is, if we know the truth, then don't let's just be censorious about it and say, oh, those dreadful Gentiles out there. When in fact, at least in our hearts and perhaps in our actions, we are in many ways identifying with them. That's the challenging thought that comes to us here from chapter 2. Notice the emphasis on this word judges. In fact, you get it really four times in this verse. We get, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest. And really the word condemnest is also judgest. It's just a slightly different form of the word. They're all based upon this word krino. For in that thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same things. So you see, four times in that verse there, he's going to talk about this matter of judging others. The actual word judging here has the connotation of condemning in it. So it's a sort of a condemnatory assessment of those that are wrong. Well, there's nothing wrong in condemning something that's wrong. Nothing wrong in condemning something that's wrong. Well, let's put it another way. There's everything right about condemning things that are wrong and condemning systems that are wrong and, where necessary, condemning people that are wrong. But if that automatically makes us feel better, then, of course, there is something wrong in that. And, you know, it's a characteristic of human nature, isn't it? You see it in the world. If you can push somebody else further down by condemning them, or by slandering them, or calumniating them, somehow or other, we feel better. Now, we haven't moved up. We've stopped there. But this other person who was somewhere here, or there, or wherever, we've pushed them down a little bit further. Therefore, that makes us feel better. Now, that's a very, very dangerous thing, because we do it. We do it a lot. And it happens in all circles of life. It happens in ecclesial life as well. That's why Paul would condemn things like gossiping and that sort of thing, because gossiping is really doing, in effect, what Paul's saying here. It's condemning somebody else so that we might feel better and make other people think that we are better. Very, very dangerous thing to do. Now, here we're seeing it, of course, in a black and white sense. The Jew here who had received the law, condemning the Gentile who hadn't received it, but the Jew is doing the same thing. The Jew, though, tries to push the Gentile down further, so he's dreadful, because that would make the Jew feel better. He's not better at all. In fact, he's worse off for it. And so, since the primary basis, then, of judgment of the Gentile world lay, as we saw in verse 18, on the basis that they suppress the truth. Remember what it said in chapter 1, verse 18, that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth, and that word hold there means to hold down, to suppress the truth. The Gentiles were suppressing the truth through their unrighteousness. What follows in this chapter is the logical sequence. So that whilst the term whosoever thou art, O man, in chapter 2 and verse 1, can mean a Jew or a Gentile, Paul is really speaking to the Jew. Now, of course, as we've said, the Jew didn't hesitate to judge the Gentile because he was separate from God, but in actual fact he was in no different case. The Jew also knew the truth but disobeyed the truth. He did the same things. So if failure to match knowledge with performance left the Gentile without an excuse, it was even more inexcusable for the Jew. Well, I would say by this stage, having come at it from all different angles, we've got a reasonably clear picture about where Paul is now heading in Romans chapter 2. He wants to show the Jew, therefore, that he's no better than the Gentile in this respect. In fact, he is much more responsible. Now, as we go through chapter 2, we're going to come across verses that are often used to prove who are responsible to God's judgment. And we'll see them in the context in which Paul uses them. I say that because, you know, from time to time in ecclesial history, issues come up like, say, the so-called responsibility question. Who are responsible to judgment? In certain parts of the world, there are two fellowships. And the thing which divides the so-called central fellowship from the so-called unamended fellowship or advocate fellowship is supposedly the issue of who are responsible for judgment. And so you'll get verses like Romans 2, say 12 to 15, being taken out and debated. And it becomes a little worrying sometimes when those things happen, because more often than not, they get taken right out of their context. All the words get put under a microscope and they become the basis of who are responsible. And really, whilst they are, of course, talking about the grounds of responsibility, I'm sure at times they get used in a totally different environment from that in which Paul wrote them. What Paul is saying here is this, that if you've been enlightened to the truth, then you have greater responsibility than those who are unenlightened. The fact is that those who are unenlightened and who disobey God's law, God's way of life, they will perish. Those who have been enlightened, they will be judged. And that's exactly what he says in verse 12. Let's preempt it by getting there. For as many as have sinned outside of the law shall also perish outside of the law. But as many as have sinned in law shall be judged by law. Now, we're not going to try and make more out of that verse than what Paul is saying. He says, here's two classes of people. They're both going to die. I don't care whether they're outside of the law and ignorant of God's purpose. They'll die like animals. They'll perish outside the law. But if you're going to be judged inside that law because you've received that law, then, of course, you will also die, but you'll die as a result of a condemnatory judgment. Now, really, that's what he's talking about in this sense, and we'll come to those verses in due course. Verses 2 and 3 are fairly clear. We are sure, says Paul in verse 2, that the judgment of God is according to truth against them which commit such things. When it says there it is according to truth, you remember we had to come to grips with the word truth back in verse 18 of chapter 1. We saw that the word truth there didn't so much mean the truth, meaning the truth of the gospel, but just a truth in relationship to the existence of God. So the word truth here is used in a different sense from the truth of the gospel. In fact, our comment is that God will judge men according to the real nature of their conduct. That's what the word truth means, the real nature of their conduct, and not as their conduct may appear unto men. So God is going to judge them. He's going to truly judge them, if you like to put it that way, and there are some translations that translate it like that. There was not one law for the Jew and another for the Gentile. God's law is according to truth. That is, it is uniform or it is consistent. So that's all verse 2 is saying. We are sure, therefore, that the judgment of God is going to be based upon truth. It will be uniform. It will be consistent against them which commit such things. So it doesn't matter whether you're a Jew, a Gentile, or a Christian. If you don't live up to the principles which God has laid down, then you will be punished. You will die. Verse 3, and thinkest thou this, O man, that judgest them which do such things, and doest the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God? Well, of course, if the Gentile rejected knowledge and suffered for it, so would the Jew. It reminds us very much, doesn't it, of Paul standing before Felix. You remember when Paul stood before Felix, he reasoned about three things, didn't he? He reasoned about righteousness, about temperance, and about judgment to come. Acts chapter 24, verse 25. He reasoned about righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. You know, that's exactly the argument Paul's following here in Romans. Righteousness, you remember back in Romans chapter 1, verse 17, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed. So he's speaking about the righteousness of God as it was in the gospel. As we move through chapter 1, he then deals with the intemperate way of life that these people were living. And so he reads about the need there for temperance. And then as we come into chapter 2 now, he's going to speak about the judgments to come. And so there's a pattern. Righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. So it's exactly the same pattern that Paul followed in Acts chapter 24 and verse 25, where he was defending himself before Felix. And as a result of that very powerful discourse, we read that Felix trembled. And so here in Romans, Paul is reasoning about righteousness, about temperance, and now he's telling them there is judgment to come for those who are going to reject God's ways. We come then to verse 4. Verse 4 says, and I'll read from the NIV on this occasion, and it's there in the notes. Or do you show contempt? Do you show contempt? The word despises there in the King James Version. Are you showing contempt for what? You're showing contempt for the riches of his kindness. Now, kindness might almost sound to us to be a little bit of a shallow word, but in checking out that word goodness, I have found that really kindness is a much better word. It's certainly the word that is favoured by a number of other translators and by concordances and so forth. And we're going to look at this word kindness, not only tonight, but it's going to come up again very powerfully later on. Are you despising the riches of his kindness, his tolerance, that is his forbearance, and his patience, or in other words, his long-suffering, not realising that it is God's kindness that leads you towards repentance? So here we have then a case of a person who was boasting in the fact that they'd received the truth. I'm a third, fourth, fifth generation Christadelphian, we sometimes hear people say. And maybe, rightly or wrongly, we look at them and think, well, you know, are they better or worse than the original generation? What virtue is there in the fact that we are a whatever generation Christadelphian? There is absolutely no virtue in it whatsoever. Absolutely none. All it does is it means that we have a greater responsibility, because there it is, deeply ingrained in family tradition, the truth. We've known nothing else but the truth. Well, what sort of a way of life should we see? Are we despising? Are we showing contempt for the riches of his kindness? So however we may have come into the truth, whether we've come in from outside and thrown away a Gentile way of life, or whether we've been born into it, matters not. It's God's kindness that we must be appreciative of. And so these Jews, resting in the fact, boasting in the fact, as Paul says later on, that they were Jews, were treating God's kindness with contempt. And they failed to appreciate that it was God's kindness that was intended to induce in them a changed way of living. I'm emphasising this word kindness because later on we're going to come to it in Romans chapter 11. And in Romans chapter 11 and verse 22 we get that word three times. Behold therefore the goodness, or rather the kindness and severity of God. And three times in that verse, you may remember how that verse goes on. In Romans chapter 11 and verse 22, where it says, behold therefore the kindness and the severity of God. On them which fell, severity. But toward you, kindness, if you continue in his kindness. Otherwise you also shall be cut off. And it's this kindness of God that we're going to be looking at from time to time, even here in this chapter this evening. So the picture we have then is of a group of people who have always been associated with the truth. They were Jews. And they were beginning to think that there must have been something good about their nation. Yes, God chose Abraham because Abraham was a man of faith. But he didn't choose every individual Jew because they were also faithful. And sometimes we say, well, I wonder why God chose me. Well, how did God choose me? Did he choose me because of some inherent goodness? He certainly did not, because there is no inherent goodness. Whatever was the basis of God causing us to come to a knowledge of the truth, we don't know, and it's probably not good to even think about it. Because if we think about it too much, we might start to think inwardly and start to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to. Let's think the other way. Let's think about that kindness that God has shown in allowing us to learn the truth. and not treat that kindness, therefore, with contempt. And so when we come to verse 5, he points out to the Jew that they were hard-hearted. He says, but because of your hard-heartedness, because of your stubbornness, because of your impenitent heart, because you are unrepentant. You see, here was a person that had observed God's kindness. God's kindness appeared to them to be just a sort of a toleration of that which was wrong, and they were treating it in a sense as weakness. Don't we sometimes do with that with human beings? If people are kind, we sometimes treat them as though they were weak, and we treat their kindness rather unkindly. Here were Jews who were treating the kindness of God with contempt, as we were told in verse 4. So they were hard-hearted people. They were stubborn. They were unrepentant. In fact, that word impenitent there in verse 5 is the negative of the word repentance at the end of verse 4. Notice that there, so the two words are related. So in verse 4 he said, we're not appreciating the kindness of God that leads to repentance, but after your stubbornness, you have been unrepentant. You've got an unrepentant heart. And therefore, he says, you are treasuring up, you're storing up to yourself wrath against the day of God's wrath when his righteous judgment will be revealed. So the argument really is very simple. Hard-hearted Jews, boasting in the fact that they were Jews, judging the Gentiles, and yet doing the same things themselves, treating God's kindness with contempt. Well, to prove his point, in verse 6, Paul quotes from Psalm 62. Let's go to Psalm 62. We said that from time to time we would endeavour to examine the background of some of the quotations that Paul uses, because all of them are important. But we won't have time to examine all of them. Let's briefly look at Psalm 62 and see how Paul uses that to substantiate his case. Because in Psalm 62, Paul picks up the very last phrase, which he says then, who will render to every man according to his deeds. So it's this expression, who will render to every man according to his deeds, which Paul picks up from the very conclusion of Psalm 62. Well, when we look at Psalm 62, we see here it is a psalm which essentially has the idea of trust. Him cometh my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defence. I shall not be greatly moved. How long will you imagine mischief against a man? You shall be slain, all of you. As a bowing wall shall you be, and a tottering fence. They only consult to cast him down from his excellency. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. And you can see, of course, how he's speaking there about the sort of person that we read about in Romans chapter 1, the sort of person that was rejecting God. The next four verses, and in fact this psalm is made up of three groups of four verses. The next group of four, which goes from 5 to 8, really says it somewhat again, similarly. Verse 5 says, my soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from him. So that's really, in effect, a repeat of verse 1 over again. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defence. I shall not be moved. And that's a repeat, you see, of verse 2. Verse 7 says, in God is my salvation and my glory, the rock of my strength, and my refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times, ye people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. And so the first two lots of four verses are virtually a repetition with just a slight different inflection. We don't want to go into the details of that at this stage. Now we come to the concluding four verses from which Paul takes his quotation. He says there, and I'm going to read from another translation. I'll tell you what the translation is. It's Moffat's translation. Doesn't mean that I always like Moffat's translation, but what he does do here is he does endeavour to bring out some aspect of the poetry, and that has a certain value in it as well. He says in verses 9 to 12, the lower ranks are but a thing of naught. The upper ranks are only a delusion. Weigh them, they prove to be lighter and slighter than a breath of air. Rely not on extortion. Pride not yourselves on robbery. If wealth increases, set not your heart on it. Now notice that this is the very thing that Paul's condemning the Jews about in chapter 2. We haven't come to it in our study, but we read it earlier tonight. He says, thus thou who condemns adultery, commit adultery. Do you who condemn idolatry, rob temples. So you see here, he says, don't adopt the way of life which you see around the Gentile world. And don't let any of us just step back from that and say, well, we don't rob temples, we don't commit adultery. Oh, look, well, there's plenty of other things that they can be identified with in the Gentile world. So with that as a background, we've got a situation very similar to the picture in Romans. We've got the Gentile world, described perhaps in, say, verses like verse 4 of the Psalm. Now we've got people here who are copying that way of life. Well, that's when we come now to the concluding verses. And in the notes here, we've got a translation which is from the NIV. In fact, the King James Version is possibly as good as any. But in order to try and pick up the poetical stanzas here, let's just read the last two verses, verses 11 and 12, perhaps from the quote we've got in the notes. You read them from whatever version you like. One thing God has spoken, two things have I heard, that you, O God, are strong. Well, the King James Version says, power belongeth unto God. So we've got here strength or power. That's one thing he says. The other thing is that you, O Yahweh, are loving. The King James Version says, merciful. See how perhaps the NIV and some other translations bring out these stanzas. You've got the idea. One thing God has spoken, two things have I heard. That you, O God, are strong, that you, O Yahweh, are loving. What's he picking up? The mercy and the severity of God, isn't he? And that's the very thing that Paul's picking up in Romans and eventually builds up to in Romans 11. Behold, therefore, the goodness and the severity of God. But at this stage in Romans chapter 2, he's focusing only on one of those two attributes, and that is the attribute of goodness or kindness. And so the psalmist has told us, therefore, that there are two attributes of God: his strength, his power, his severity, his judgment. But on the other hand, his mercy, his love, his kindness. And so the psalmist concludes, surely you will reward each person according to what he has done. And that's what Paul picks up. So when Paul quotes those concluding words of Psalm 62, he's expecting us to see the context in which it occurs. So what is the psalm? The psalm is a psalm inducing people to have confidence in Yahweh as their rock and their refuge, because he will keep them from the dreadful Gentile world about them. Rely on Yahweh, he says, to strengthen you. Furthermore, he says, don't be like the Gentiles. Don't copy them in their ways. Acknowledge that Yahweh has two aspects to his character: his mercy and his judgment. And Yahweh will reward you according to what you have done. Now, of course, when we go back then to Romans chapter 2, in the context, Paul is using those words as a warning that for those who don't obey Yahweh, they will come into judgment, they will receive from him his severity. And of course, later on, point out that we should behold, therefore, the goodness and the severity of God. So going back then to Romans chapter 2, just picking up that theme, let's just read again from the King James Version, verses 4 to 6, to pick up the thread of his argument. Or do you despise, do you treat with contempt the riches of his kindness, his goodness, his forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God is leading you to a changed way of life? But after the hardness and the unrepentant nature of your heart, you're treasuring up to yourself wrath. And don't forget, that was the wrath that he'd spoken about back in chapter 1 and verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, both Gentile and Jew. You're storing up to yourself, you Jews, wrath. Not mercy. You're storing up to yourself wrath against the day of wrath and the revelation of the righteous judgment of God, Psalm 62, who will render to every man according to his deeds. But whilst he's quoting Psalm 62 to prove that God's wrath will be poured out, Psalm 62 reminds us But there were two things that the psalmist saw. He saw that God was also a God of love and a God of mercy. And so whilst there is wrath promised there, Paul is threatening them with the fact that they will receive God's wrath, the psalmist still tells us that we should also be partakers of his mercy if we don't treat his kindness with contempt. He says in verse 7, "But to them who paid by patient continuance in well-doing, seek for glory, honour and immortality, there will be eternal life." So there is to be a contrast. What are they seeking for? It doesn't say to those who are seeking to earn eternal life, does he? He says to those who are seeking glory, honour and immortality. But glory, honour and immortality are all attributes of God. God is the source of all glory. God is the one who deserves honour. Immortality belongs to God alone, we're told by Paul in another place. So what we are seeking for, therefore, is to manifest, aren't we, the glory of God. So to those who are seeking, by patient continuance in well-doing, glory, honour and immortality, such a person will obtain eternal life. But by contrast, says verse 8, and we might as well read verses 8 to 11 straight through because it's a simple flow of the argument here. "But unto them that are contentious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, there will be indignation and wrath and tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that doeth evil, of the Jew first and also of the Gentile." Now, if back in chapter 1 Paul could say that he is not ashamed of the gospel of Christ in verse 16 because it is the power of God unto salvation to the Jew first and to the Gentile, so is God's judgment. God's judgment will be to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. Why the Jew first? Because the Jew had received greater privilege. And so we could very readily extend that immediately and say, let the Jew there stand as an example of anybody who has received the privilege of understanding God's way. God's judgment will be poured out upon them in greater measure, in the sense that the unknowing world, the world who do not know God, will simply perish, whereas these people will be held responsible and answerable to God. So to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile. For there is no respect of persons with God. There is, in the ultimate, no difference between a Jew and a Gentile. Prior to the law of Moses, there were no such things as Jews and Gentiles. And then, since the law of Moses ended, there really aren't such things as Jews and Gentiles in the absolute sense. We know that God does have a purpose for the Jewish nation as such. But human beings are human beings, whether they be Jews or Gentiles. And as Paul pointed out to the Galatians, that when you're in Christ, there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, male nor female, you're all one. So he was endeavouring to bring the Jew down to a state of realising that he was a human being after all, and he stood in the position where God's judgment will be poured out upon him just as much as upon anybody else. The section verses 12 to 16 really has to be seen as being one sentence which starts in verse 12 and then concludes in verse 16, with verses 13 to 15 being in parenthesis, that is, like in brackets. Now, we struck that sort of thing before, didn't we? We had it back in chapter 1, where we had a sentence that started in verse 18 and finished in verse 32. Let's read, therefore, verses 12 and 16 and see how we're now coming into the section where he's going to be outlining the grounds of man's responsibility to God. Verse 12 says, "For as many as have sinned without law," that is, outside of the law, "shall also perish without law. And as many as have sinned in law shall be judged by law, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. Now that's what he's saying. But verses 13, 14 and 15 are going to be an explanation of what he is saying in verse 12. But there's the simple statement. There are going to be those who are outside law, they will perish outside law. Those who have received law, be it God's law in whatever sense, they will be judged by law. So notice the difference of the two words there. Perish as against judge. It might be appropriate to, because there are, we need to have our thinking caps on a little bit in these verses, if we follow our notes actually fairly closely at this stage, because I've tried to word this fairly carefully. Towards the bottom of page 16, we make the statement, verses 12 to 16 contain a statement which begins in verse 12 and is completed in verse 16. Right, that's, we've said that. Verses 13 to 15 are therefore in parenthesis and are Paul's proof of the impartiality of God's judgment, that as many as have sinned without law shall perish without law in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men, verse 16. And as many as have sinned under law shall be judged by law in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men, verse 16. Now let's take up this word law. You might have noted there that I omitted the definite article, the law. In fact, it's probably worth noting that at this stage because he's not talking merely about the law of Moses. There is a sense in which some of these verses apply to the law of Moses, but really it's talking about God's law in the general sense of the term. You might like to just do it with pencil if you want to be cautious at this stage, but just to note it, reading through these verses 13 and 14 at this stage, it would be like this. For as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law, and as many as have sinned in law, so you can cross out that the there, that the there, you can cross out the word the in front of law, shall be judged by law, cross out that one. For not the hearers of law, cross out the thee, are just before God, but the doers of law shall be justified. For when the Gentiles which have not law, cross out thee, do by nature the things contained in the law, you can leave the thee in there, these having not law are a law unto themselves. So we left one in and all of the rest of them went out. You can check that from the diaglot or wherever you like. So as our comment says, the word law, while often used of the Mosaic law, does not exclusively apply to the Mosaic law. Law in this instance is to be understood as a revelation of God's will. And that's a quote taken direct from Brother Carter's comments in his book on the Romans. So what we're being told then in verse 12, as we've already seen, is that those who sin without law will simply perish. Those who sin under the law, or under law, will be judged. Brother Carter paraphrases this verse to read like this. As many as have sinned in disobeying the truth, verse 8, outside covenant relationship, will perish when Christ comes. Their doom is sealed. But as many as have sinned in covenant relationship will be judged, for they have stood related to a possible reception of glory, honour and immortality. And I would like just to remind you what I said earlier, I don't want to take that verse outside of its context. I don't want anyone to say to me therefore, well, does that mean that enlightened sinners aren't going to be judged? That's not the topic of the thing. We're not trying to use that verse to prove or disprove all of the different grades of people that stand before the judgment seat. We're simply taking the argument as Paul uses it here, and we're not trying to make anything more out of it. So that's what he's saying there, is there are two classes of people in the context of his argument here, those who are not under law and those who are under law. One will perish, the other will be judged. And he's not saying they are the only two grades we've got. And I say I make that comment because sometimes these verses are taken and they're really viewed microscopically to prove all sorts of different things to substantiate what people want them to say. Verse 13. For not the hearers of law are just before God, but the doers of law shall be justified. Now he's really getting to the crux of the issue here. The Jew says, because I've heard the law, that automatically makes me righteous. And we sit back and say, well, how stupid. How could a person reason like that? Do you think there's a possibility we might? I think there is. I think there's a possibility that every one of us in this hall could possibly do that. I think we could. The fact that we have heard the truth somehow just makes us feel as though we are just better than other people. It just starts to rub off on you. If you were a Jew, you were being told all the time that you're different from the Gentiles. If you're a Christadelphian, you're being told all the time that you're different from the Gentiles. So we start to believe we're different, therefore we just start to think that we're automatically different. And we stop analysing really whether we are in practice really different. And so you see, it could be that we could be like these people. Because we've heard the law, we think, therefore, that we are obeying it, I suppose. See, the Jews as a class constantly heard the law taught in their synagogues, but they didn't apply it in principles. And so these verses 13 to 15 here, being, as we've said, in parenthesis, serve to emphasise the point that a man must be a doer of the word and not just a hearer. Verses 14 and 15, once we've got through those, the rest of the chapter is very simple, and really there's only one thing in verses 14 and 15 that we've got to come to grips with, because on the surface it sounds very, very wrong. And these, incidentally, were the two verses that I quoted, if you remember, in last time's notes, and you'll see now why I don't want to quote those to prove what we said last time. For when the Gentiles, which have not law, do by nature the things contained in the law. Do by nature. Does that mean to say that there's some inherent goodness in them, and these Gentiles have got some sort of moral conscience which says, oh, well, I'm obeying God's law because there's just something inherently there? Well, of course, the Gentile commentators make a real mess of this verse, because most of them believe in the inherent goodness of human nature. So it's talking about some Gentiles who just by nature obey God, because they were just better than other people. They're just good. You know, some of us have inherent goodness. Well, we don't. But you see, that's the way it was thinking. You know, why did God call me? Oh, perhaps because he saw that I was potentially better than somebody else. Well, it doesn't mean that at all. But it appears to say that, doesn't it? And my comment in last time's notes almost appeared to give support to that idea. That's why I wanted to get rid of it. For when the Gentiles which have not law do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. Now look, leave out the by nature part at the moment. It's quite simple, isn't it, what it's saying? It's saying here that there are some Gentiles that weren't brought up under the law of Moses like you Jews, but they're living a better way of life than you Jews, who are boasting in the law. That's what it's saying, isn't it? It's simply saying that. But what does it mean by nature? Well, let's look at our note. It says, this does not mean that it was part of their nature to obey God's law. For Paul has already made this fact clear in his description of the Gentile world left to its own devices in chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. So it's obviously not their nature. He says in chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, leave a Gentile to himself and look what mess he'll get into. So it's not by nature in that sense of the term. It speaks rather of those who have been influenced by the word and embrace the truth. These obey the spirit of the law, as verse 15 says, because their consciences have been affected. The requirements, or the AV says, the work of the law consisted in an acceptance of its principles, which thereby developed an acquired nature. Or, if you happen to look at a footnote in the Diaglot, And the Diaglot has a footnote to this word nature, where it says that the word, as used in the Greek, and it gives other examples of it in certain places, means not so much the nature that we're born with, but a nature we acquire, a disposition which is infused. So what happens is that there were Gentiles who were not born into the Jewish race, but they come to a knowledge of the truth, which we will call God's law, and they so diligently apply themselves to it that it becomes a new way of life. It becomes an acquired nature. It becomes an infused disposition. And so this became an acquired nature, or an infused disposition, in conformity with the mind of Christ. It is only when the work of the law is written in their hearts that they can be said to be a law unto themselves. So really the only difficulty in that verse is that expression by nature, and if we can understand that, it doesn't mean the nature they were born with, but if you like, a new way of thinking, a new nature, which is an acquired one or an infused one. And as we said, there's a footnote in the Diaglot which says that, and it refers to the actual Greek word there, which I haven't got noted in the notes, but if you've got a Diaglot you can look it up. Steve, you got your Diaglot there? Could you read out just the relevant part of that note down the bottom?
This passage relates not to unconverted, unconverted, but to converted Gentiles. Ignatius used the word in the same view when he addressed the Ephesians and Legion. Having heard your name of the love of God, which you have attained by your righteous disposition, which is a Judaic, that's the great word.
Righteous disposition. Yep.
According to the faith and love which is in Jesus Christ our Saviour, that Parker doesn't have a comment on it.
So he says that Ignatius, in one of his letters, uses the word, and it's translated as righteous disposition. So you see, this is where we have here an infused disposition. It's a nature which has been acquired as a result of accepting God's law. And so the argument here, which might seem a rather almost circuitous type of reasoning, it's the sort of reasoning that would have affected Jewish minds, because Jews reasoned out like this. So what he is simply saying to the Jews is this: here are Gentiles who've come to a knowledge of a law which has been given to you. Their way of life has been changed. They have now got an acquired nature which they've acquired from understanding God's law. They've got a new disposition which has been infused in them. And what are you doing? You're saying, oh no, they haven't got any hope because they're Gentiles. And so they've got it all back to front. And so if we come down, perhaps just coming down the page a little further, you see the word thus there sticking out in the margin. This was the contrast. Thus the Jews claimed a legal standing before God, yet their actions were not in conformity with this claim. The Gentiles' actions revealed their affinity with God, but the Jews denied them legal standing. See the argument? That's the way it goes. All right, so that expression then, by nature, means an acquired disposition. Their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another. I simply note there that particular word accusing and the word excusing, if you look up those quotes in Acts 24 and Acts 25, you'll find that they were used in Paul's trial before Felix and before Festus. And so it's like a court case. Here are Gentiles whose consciences are accusing and excusing. They're examining themselves. They're saying, that is wrong, that is right. I cannot allow this, I will allow that. And their consciences were all the time being worked upon on the basis of their understanding of the word. That's what they were doing. Their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another. The interesting thing is, you see that word excusing there, that's the opposite to the very word that we had right back in verse 1, thou art therefore inexcusable, O man. There's no excuse for you. But you see, the word, the Gentiles were using the word to judge their consciences. And they knew either to accuse or to excuse certain things. It's like a positive and a negative, isn't it? I can do that, I can't do that. I must do this, I mustn't do that. But what was the Jew saying? The Jew just said, well, I'm a Jew, I'm all right, I don't have to worry about those things. And so those Gentiles, they can try as hard as they like. They're not Jews. Wouldn't matter what they did, they've got no hope because they're not Jews. And that's the way they were starting to think. And so verse 16 then completes the sentence, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. Verses 17 to 29 deal with the failure of the Jews. Now, really, and I think it would be worth the attempt to finish this tonight, and I think we can do it without extending the class more than about 5 minutes more than what we should do. I think it would be worth going right through this because the argument's already been laid. There's nothing new here, except now he's turning around and saying, verse 17, behold, you are called a Jew. Now, he hasn't said that before, has he? He's just saying, oh man. He's making it quite clear now that it's the Jew that he's got very much in mind. So in this section, Paul speaks directly to the Jew, and in so doing, draws a picture of unwarranted self-satisfaction and boastful security. The fact that God had given them a law was regarded as a mark of favour. But the reception of a law was not in itself a ground of satisfaction. The keeping of it would have been. So we can summarise verses 17 through to 21, and we shall do so. The Jews rested, we are told. They took their stand on the law. We're told that they boasted of God, because, verse 18, they knew his will. They were able to approve or to discern the things that are more excellent or superior. In other words, they knew the difference between right and wrong because they'd been instructed by the law. They were confident of being able to lead the blind Gentile. And the words of Isaiah that belong to Christ, they appropriated to themselves, a light of them that sit in darkness. The Jews saw himself, verse 20, as a teacher, not as a student, because contained in the law was the embodiment of knowledge and truth, the external form or shape of knowledge and truth. And so you see, we can summarise it like this. The privileges enumerated determined the Jew's estimate of his relationship to other men. Meant he was a guide, the rest were blind. He was the light, the others were in darkness. He was an instructor and a teacher, they were foolish and like babes. And we do look out upon a world who are blind and in darkness, and they are foolish. But by the very fact of us condemning them, doesn't automatically make us right. It's got to be seen in a way of life. Otherwise, if we are living just like them, then we are in a far worse position than what they are. In the verses which we considered, verses 13 to 15, Paul had shown how the truth had transformed Gentiles. Why should it not also transform the Jew? In verse 21, Paul was making the point there very powerfully. He was pressing home the principles which we'd seen back in verse 1. The man who said, don't steal, but he stole. The man who declaimed adultery and idolatry, yet committed both, made his boast of the law, yet by not upholding what he proclaimed, he dishonoured God. And so as we read through those particular verses, we take it up, say, from verse 21. Thou therefore which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, do you steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou commit sacrilege? Thou that makest thy boast of the law, through breaking the law, dishonorest thou God. And so he says, quoting from Isaiah, for the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written. And he's quoting there from Isaiah 52. In effect, he's saying, you quote Isaiah 42, we're a light to the Gentiles. Well, he said, yes, but what I would quote is Isaiah 52. And I'm saying that the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Brother Carter made a comment in his book on the Romans, which I thought was very good. In fact, it's noted here too, I see in the notes. It has been said that the world is a better logician. They work on logic rather than a theologian, and it is so in every age. It is easier to test a believer's actions than to test his beliefs. And so the belief is generally estimated by the action. The Christadelphian is more easily scrutinised than the truth is examined. How careful should the name-bearer of God be? So the message coming through is very simple indeed. It's all right us going around telling people what the truth's all about. They expect to see it. And people are more likely to believe it if they can see it in action. And so verse 4:25 says, "For circumcision verily profiteth if thou keep the law, but if thou be a breaker of the law, thy circumcision is made uncircumcision." So really what he's saying is it's useless to boast in your circumcision because your actions really bear the mark of uncircumcision. Similarly in verse 26, "Therefore if the uncircumcision keep the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted for circumcision?" Now this is typical reasoning which would appeal to the Jewish mind. It's just saying that it is equally wrong to label one whose righteous conduct bears the stamp of circumcision as uncircumcision. If obedience to God is the important thing, then such a Gentile is what a Jew ought to be and is more entitled to the name than a Jew is by birth. A comment from John Carter. All he's saying is, look, there's someone out there you're calling a Gentile, but I'm telling you they're living the truth better than you. They should really be called a Jew, and you should be called a Gentile. So don't boast in the fact that you have received God's law. Verse 27, "And shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, if it fulfil the law, judge thee, who by the letter and circumcision dost transgress the law?" So if any judging is to take place, who is more fitted to judge? The naturally uncircumcised, but spiritually circumcised, or the legally circumcised, but spiritually uncircumcised? And of course the answer is quite obvious. And so Paul concludes then in verses 28 and 29 when he says, "For he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh." We might add, he is not a Christadelphian who is one that has merely believed the gospel and been immersed. That of course is the start, but that doesn't make him a Christadelphian in reality. That just simply makes him one outwardly. The one who is a true Jew, a true Christadelphian, is one who is one not outwardly, but who is one inwardly. And so verse 29 says, "But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God." The word inwardly there is rather an interesting word because we did strike it earlier, but I didn't comment on it at the time. In verse 16, we read there that these things are going to be revealed in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men. And that word secrets there is exactly the same word as this word inwardly. See, a secret is something which is concealed, which is kept inside, which nobody can see. It's a secret. And so that's what he's saying. "But he is a Jew, which is one whose Jewishness is concealed." It's private. It's secret. In fact, the Diaglot translates it, "The Jew is hidden within." Isn't that a beautiful thing? The Jew is hidden within. So the true Jew is the one where the law of God has really affected the heart. And so we come then to what is in fact the end of a very simple section from chapter 1 and chapter 2. God's righteousness has been revealed in the gospel. That gospel is going to reveal to us the mercy of God, his kindness, which he is appealing to you, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, to take hold of. The Gentile world at large has rejected it. Even though they may not even have heard the gospel, they know that what they do is wrong, and therefore, although they are outside God's law, they will perish. But there are others, some of whom are Jews, boasting in the fact that they received God's law. They likewise act the same way. They will be judged and condemned by God. What should we do? Well, we should be like those who, by patient continuance in well-doing, seek for glory, honour and immortality. Those are the people who shall obtain eternal life. But the concluding point in Romans 3 is really a very beautiful one, even though it is somewhat concealed. Reading verse 29, he says, "But he is a Jew, which is hidden within, if you like. Even having circumcision of the heart, whose praise is not of men, but of God. And the rather interesting thing which is concealed there in our translation, of course, is that the word Jew is simply a contraction of the word Judah. That's where the word Jew comes from. It's simply a contracted form of the word Judah. And the word Judah, of course, means praise. And so what he's saying is here, but he is a Jew, and the word Jew really means praise. He is one who really brings praise to God, whose praise of God is there within the heart. So he is a Jew, which is one inwardly. Circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit and not in the letter, whose praise, in other words, whose true Jewishness is not of men because of circumcision in the flesh, but it is of God because of an acquired nature, an infused disposition in which there is hidden within true praise of God. And of course that brings us through a full circle where we saw that the problem with the Gentile world was it ceased to be thankful, it no longer praised God for his goodness. And so can we go away from our study this evening realising that the kindness of God has been extended, we will be eternally thankful to him, and the praise which we extend to him will not be simply in words, but will come forth from a heart full of praise, reminding us of Paul's words in Ephesians, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, making melody in your heart to the Lord. In other words, a heart full of praise indicates that here is a true Jew, not one simply of men, but one of God.